I spent a lot of my time out in the middle of the street turning Germans around who are facing the wrong direction trying to take their freewheeling cover picture. And I want to make sure they get it right. So, I'm living on streets that I knew existed from song lyrics and from liner notes, and the stuff that made me, you know, want to play guitar.
The fertile grounds of the music Steve Earle grew up on are now his neighborhood. And on the new album, Washington Square Serenade, he sings to the people and challenges of life around him and the love he found along the way. Today on Words of Music from Studio A, a conversation and performance with Steve Earle and special guest Allison Moorer.
Words and Music is supported by McVicker and Higginbotham. Information at mcvh.com.
Hi, I'm Rita Houston. It's no secret that among the acclaimed songs and albums of Steve Earle's past are a few dark times and hard-won challenges from jail to addiction that he's overcome. But the latest entry in the Steve Earle story shines a much brighter light, one that might leave the faithful surprised but not questioning the artistic results. You see, Steve Earle has found love in wife Allison Moorer and inspiration in his new hometown of New York City. And the impact on the man and the songwriter now makes its way onto record with Earle's first album in 3 years, Washington Square Serenade. So in addition to new songs, sounds, and politics, Steve Earle has a whole new city to explore. And before host Claudia Marshall finds out how both Steve and Allison could be future tour guides in New York City, let's listen in on a track from the album called Steve's Hammer.
Days I'm gonna lay this hammer down. I won't have to drag this weight around. When there ain't no hunger and there ain't no pain, I won't have to swing this thing. One of these days I'm gonna lay this hammer down.
New music from Steve Earle on WFUV. And looky here. Steve is in Studio A. Hello.
How are you?
Welcome back.
Yeah, this is a little bigger than the old place. I've actually haven't been here since the new studios.
Yeah.
So this is nice.
I know. It's almost like a real radio station, huh?
Well, it was always a real radio station. Keep in mind, the first radio station I ever got on in my life was a Pacifica station in Houston that was the transmitter was constantly being blown up by the Ku Klux Klan. And, you know, we were literally in closets, you know, for a lot of shows there. But you know, it's a real radio station if it gets on the airwaves. But this is nice, a lot more room.
Well, it's nice to see you, and it's very nice to have a new record from you, which I would venture to say is maybe the happiest sounding Steve Earle record we've had, if not in some time, possibly ever. Would you agree?
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, I don't consider myself to be particularly morose, and I even some of the stuff I've been through, I've always consider myself to be fairly optimistic. You know, I was sort of, as an artist, you know, raised by Townes Van Zandt and Guy Clark, and it was Townes that said there's two kinds of music. There's the blues and there's zippity-doo-dah, and I do subscribe to that to a certain extent. But it, you know, it is, I'm definitely happier, and I don't, you know, I'm not an unhappy person. This record's maybe less angry than the last couple, but you know, it doesn't mean I'm not angry anymore either. It means that I was concentrating on, you know, being in love and moving to New York City. And it didn't make it apolitical either. There's still, you know, political content on the record. And they're always, Copperhead Road's a pretty political record. You know, the idea of me, you know, it wasn't so much that the idea of me writing political music was new. It was more, there were voices out there that sort of wanted to discredit anyone that was making any kind of art that dealt with politics, as if, you know, artists had suddenly stepped over this line. And the truth of the matter is that's our job, and it always has been. I mean, I don't care what Britney Spears thinks about politics either, but I'm not Britney Spears. And there's nothing wrong with crafting pop music. I love pop music, but you know, I did make a decision. Trust me, I could have made a lot more money than I've made now if I decided to do things differently, you know, 20 years ago.
Mm. Well, I think it's safe to say that you have found yourself, A, a good woman, and B, a good city.
Yeah, this is what this record is. It's love songs for Allison Moorer in New York City for the most part. We needed a place that was ours. That was part of it. And I'd always considered coming here, and I got a radio thing that I do too, which had started to bring me to the city on a fairly regular basis. And And I've always loved it. And Danny Goldberg, who's our manager, you know, has plotted for years and years to get me to, you know, he owned Artemis, which is the record label I recorded for 10 years. And he'd been conspiring to get me to move to New York. He began by, when he still had Artemis and I was still recording The Revolution Starts Now was coming out, he rented me an apartment on Bleecker Street, you know, in the atrium, in those corporates there, right in the middle of the Elephant Walk. And I was basically here to, you know, promote the record, do interviews, and harass Republicans during the Republican National Convention and during the last election cycle. And you know, he knew he'd have me at that point, and he did. I started trying to figure out how to. And then, you know, I married a girl with a job, so it became financially feasible to live in New York City.
What a concept. And we should mention that Allison Moore is here. Welcome back, Allison. It's great to see you.
Thank you. It's good to see you.
Married a girl with a job. How long ago did you guys tie the knot?
A little over 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Oh, has it been that long now?
It was, and we got married as soon as we could after we met. But it was
a Thursday because it was festival season.
Yeah, it was festival season. We spent our honeymoon. We literally got married at the Hermitage Hotel in Nashville and got on a bus that night.
Yeah.
And rode to a show in Utah somewhere. And we ended up playing. We played the Rocky Mountain Folks Festival and then went directly from, you know, the next night, and then went directly from the stage there to Camp Casey. I saw Cindy Sheehan the other day in San Francisco, and I introduced her to an audience at a festival there, and it was literally true. I told the audience, well, we spent our honeymoon at Camp Casey.
So I guess you could do a little worse than that.
Yeah, no, it was good. It was like, you know, we spent the last couple of years mainly syncing up release schedules so that we can tour together. And trust me, that's not about marketing. That's about trying to stay married.
Well, let's talk a little bit about, actually, let's not talk anymore. Can I get you to sing? This first song that's on the record sets it up beautifully, and I'd love to hear you play that, Steve.
Pedal on the floor, out in New York City, and I won't be back no more. Won't be back no more, boys won't see me around. Goodbye, guitar town. Goes out on the highway, voices on the wind, telling me we may never pass this way again. Voices on the highway, angels beckoning like a long lost friend. Fare thee well, I'm bound to roam. This ain't never been my home. Stranger in my mirror, lines around my eyes, string around my finger, but I don't remember why. Don't remember why, boys, don't remember how. Goodbye, Guitar Town. Side across the mighty Hudson River to the New York City side. Redhead by my side, boy, sweetest thing I found. Goodbye, Guitar Town.
Song from the new Steve Earle record, live here in Studio A. The leadoff song from the new one's called Tennessee Blues. Beautiful song, Steve. And obviously very autobiographical. Blue dog? What's a blue dog?
Blue dog's Bo. He's an Australian cattle dog. It turns out there are more Australian cattle dogs, you know, downtown in New York City than I thought there were. All their names begin with B's. So ours is called Bo, and he's six, I guess, he's been all over North America. We can't take the dogs to Europe, but we do. You know, we live on the bus when we tour in the States, and just take the dogs and the band and crew go in hotels and we stay on the bus, and mainly because it's that way you don't have. I remember Bo one time being on, you know, like the elevator door open and the entire L.A. Lakers dressed in purple, you know, and really huge people, and freaked him out. You know, it's just surprises like that, getting dogs in and out of hotels.
I thought you were going to say the Lakers were freaked out.
No, the Lakers were freaked out, too. They were, like, literally pushing buttons trying to get the elevator to go away
There's a photo of Bo, right? Is that Bo?
Yeah, that's Bo. And it's actually a representation of Bo in the cover art as well.
I wanted to ask you about the cover art.
That's Bo in Washington Square, because that's where Bo is every afternoon. You know,
is that right?
Because we live in the village, and so that's our dog run. Bo knows that place very well.
So it kind of surprised me to hear you say in the song that, you know, Nashville was never really home.
Well, I mean, I lived there 30 years, but I wasn't there very much. And it's one of those things that, you know, I don't think it's any, you know, secret that my politics are somewhat to the left of
Chairman Mao, didn't you once say?
Yeah, Chairman Mao on some issues. I mean, I'm not a Maoist, but I'm in fact I'm kind of I'm a whole different kind of communist. But it's one of those deals. I was able to live there because I traveled so much. I got to see the rest of the world. I spent time in New York. I spent time in London. I spent time in Paris, and so I was okay. And then, you know, you start thinking about, I'm 52, and I'll be 53 by the time this tour gets going good, and you know, one of these days, I may not be able to get around as well as I do now, and I won't have that luxury of being, you know, in the course of a year, I'll go to Europe three or four times, and I do get to Australia, and I get to Asia occasionally. But if I had something that kept me from being able to do that, do I want to be in Nashville, Tennessee? You know, I'd rather be one of those, you know, old farts in the village in a power wheelchair running over your foot, you know. That just, like, looks like a better way to go out to me than being stuck, you know, stuck in a car. You know, that's the other thing. It's just not driving a car and not having to deal with that. Being able to literally walk one block in either direction from my apartment and for $2 start a journey to anywhere in the world sounds kind of democratic to me right now. And it's just living in a world-class city and having the world come to you.
Steve Earle is with us in Studio A today. I'm Claudia Marshall. And your bride, Allison Moore, is here. Can I ask how you two met?
We met in the hallway at what was E Squared Records, because Allison's friends with Tracy Thomas, who was our publicist at E Squared. Tracy's an independent publicist, but all the E Squared stuff, you know, she represented. And she and Tracy were friends, so I think that's
how
we met.
Yeah, that was the first time we met.
And then, you know, we'd bump into each other once in a while. But I got into this thing, you know, beginning with my sister and Garrison Starr, of inviting women out to open shows because it gave me a duet partner during my show. And when The Revolution Starts Now came out, that act was Allison. And it was just sort of something we didn't plan on. It started out being a tour, and it ended up being, you know, a whole another thing.
Something
I served
else entirely.
Him coffee once.
You served him coffee?
In 1996.
Oh, Fido. Yep.
I worked at this coffee shop called Fido, and he came in and got some coffee. And he doesn't remember it.
You knew who he was?
Yeah, of course I did. It was my last real job. You don't remember that, do you?
I don't guess I do. I remember Jared serving me coffee at Fido, or actually at Bongo, but I never, you know, I don't remember you ever serving.
It was a fleeting moment.
I didn't go to that place that much. I went to the other one. I went to their other joint over there.
So you guys didn't have maybe a honeymoon per se immediately. Did you have a first date proper?
I think we went to a movie on the road.
Yeah, we went. Yeah. It was weird. We started, you know, it was one of those things that we just sort of, it kind of snuck up on us. All of a sudden, we were eating together every day at catering, you know, because in you know, on a tour, we're touring, and with the rock band in England and Ireland, it's the only place that I carry production, you know, and catering and all that stuff, just because it's affordable there and it's the best way to do it in the venues that we normally play. And so it was just one of those deals, and we just started hanging out together, you know, before we went on every night. And I started out putting her on stage every night, just because it can be tough being, you know, and I've been in the position of being, you know, playing solo and acoustic and in front of a rock band. And you go out there and there's people there, you know, like, or drunk, and, you know, is one problem. And there's, it's, you know, it was when, you know, you need all the help you can get when you're out there. So I put Allison on every night, and we just started hanging out together. And, you know, we went to the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam, and we went to, you know, a bunch of other places. I go a lot of places that I didn't used to go, you know, in Amsterdam. I didn't know there were museums in Amsterdam until like 1994 or 5 or something like that. But it just, you know, it was just one of those things that sort of happened. And then we looked up, by the time we got to Paris, it was like, uh-oh. And we had to sort of make some phone calls and sort some stuff out.
I like that. By the time we got to Paris.
It literally was, yeah. Paris that we kind of turned ourselves in.
City of Light. All right, Steve Earle and Allison Moore, will you play one for us?
Yeah, this is, I've written a lot of duets, this thing with a lot of girls, because I sort of fascinated with the form. It allows you to write for, you know,
which
right
form?
Duets.
You're not the only one, dear.
Yeah, I know. All right. I'm just going to shut up. I mean, I have a lot, you know.
Yeah.
I got stuff to do. 2, 3, 4.
Another year is come and gone, another circle around the sun, another thousand tears have fallen. I don't ever count them, 'cause I'm surrounded by your love, and days are never long enough. More seasons on parade show their colors, then they fade. That won't happen to us, darling. We'll remember how it was, then begin again, because days are never long enough. Time's never late, isn't bound by our fate. Try as we may, love might never be found if we wait until the sun comes up on another day, my love. Days are never long enough. Never late, isn't bound by our fate. Try as we may, love might never be found if we wait until the sun comes up on another day, my love. Days are never long enough.
Steve Earle and Allison Moore are with us in Studio A today, and a song that is on the new Steve Earle record. I get this sort of Beatles-esque feeling from that
one. Well, it's Beatles, but it's kind of the way it fit into the record. I mean, you know, I'm sort of known for stealing from the Beatles.
And, well, and who isn't?
Recording techniques for years, the way that, you know, I had a recording studio which just finally ended, but it was everything we did was based on the way the Beatles made records and based on the theory that, no records had been made that sounded any better than that. And but this was more about, because of the record and where I was writing it, it was more like, you know, the connection between folk music and the rock music that was influenced by it. So it was as much about the Love and Spoonful, who were probably the closest thing, you know, that we produced to the Beatles over here. And especially the connection between, you know, that neighborhood. I mean, John Sebastian literally grew up in the Village, and, you know, and he was sort of on the ground floor of all that stuff. He watched all that happen. He was kind of the kid around it, and he took all those influences. I remember the night I met him was at Town Hall at this it was a concert commemorating the Friends of Old Time Music concerts, which were, you know, Izzy Young and John Cohen and some people put together these concerts that began. Most the original ones were at PS 41, and there were other venues that were misappropriated from NYU in the neighborhood and in the late 50s and early 60s. And it's the reason Clarence Ashley came to New York City for the first time. And when Clarence Ashley came to New York City for the first time, Doc Watson, who was in his 20s, came with him. And you know, people were starting to find these people that some people thought were dead that were on these great records that were part of the Harry Smith anthology. And, you know, Harry Smith was in the neighborhood. And you know, it's one of those things. And now we literally live on the street that Bob Dylan and Susie Rotala are walking down on the cover of the Free Will and Bob Dylan. Susie's still in the neighborhood. Her book's getting ready to come out, which I can't. There's been a lot of really good books about being around there. But in the case of Susie, she's somebody that literally grew up in that neighborhood and watched that come into her world, so I'm looking forward to that one. But it's been a trip living there. I'm living on streets that I knew existed from song lyrics and from liner notes. You know, from the stuff that made me, you know, want to play guitar.
Back to the song that you guys just did together, I'm really struck by how beautifully your voices blend. How much work went into finding the right balance?
Well, it's not. We just sing together, and it seems to work, and it shouldn't. You know, technically speaking, it probably shouldn't. I mean, we're pretty. I've sung with a lot of people, and sometimes it works. I mean, we've tried to. We started out singing together, singing songs that I wrote to sing with other people. She sung songs with me that I sang with Emmy, and you know, well, I got her to sing one that I sang with Irish Dement once. I haven't been able to get her to sing it again, but it was like, it's really high. And that's one thing, Iris and I, that song was always tough for Iris to perform because it's really, really high, it's from the mountain. And we've always, it's been a pretty natural thing for us. This was actually the first thing that we sort of, you know, our first duet together was, you know, there were Emmy songs, and then we started doing Where Have All the Flowers Gone a couple of years ago. I think we learned it originally for a rally in Washington.
It was just, I was bugging you for something else to sing together because I was getting tired of the few that we knew. And I grew up a harmony singer, so yes, I tend to just listen and try to blend however I can. And Steve's a good harmony singer, too. You know, don't let him stand back.
I'm the worst harmony singer in the world. It's always been a weak point for me, you know. I'm just kind of learning to do it. But you can't. My whole life has been based, especially the last 10 years, on never thinking that I'm too old to learn anything. Mary Martin, who's really dear friend of mine, I mean, she signed Emmy Lou Harris to Warner Brothers Records. She introduced the band to Dylan because she's Canadian. She worked for Albert Grossman here in New York City when she was 18 or 19 years old. But she told me once when I was in my 30s, she goes, "It's a shame, Steve Earle, that you never moved to New York because now you'll never do it." And so this is a lot of this was just, you know, proving Mary Martin wrong.
Just talk a little bit about how you handle working together. For instance, Allison, are you able to give Steve input on his work? Constructive criticism?
If I'm asked, I'm very careful about, you know, because Lord knows, everybody knows I'm not short on opinions. But And being an artist myself, I understand the process, and I don't want to stick my nose in where it's A, not needed, and B, not wanted. And I try to be really careful about weighing in unless I'm asked. And from time to time, you know, when Steve was writing this record, he asked me a couple of times what I thought about this or that, and I would say, but I think one of the last songs that he wrote was a song called Satellite Radio. And when he first started writing, I was like, honey, I don't know. I don't know about that one. And then, of course, he proved me wrong. So I'll never do that again.
What was it you didn't like about it at first?
I think it was, sometimes I get worried about songs dating themselves if there's certain words in them that make them seem like, oh, this song came from the year 2004. But he totally proved me wrong.
Never, ever worry about that.
He doesn't. And because he's a better songwriter.
Well, it's not that. It's just that, you know, you write some songs that are going to be timeless, and you write some songs that are not, and you write songs that are locked into the time that they're written, and it's part of my job. And I don't, you know, I mean, somebody asked me recently about the songs on The Revolution Starts Now and Jerusalem, you know, aren't you afraid those songs become obsolete, you know, as times change? And I said, well, I write songs like that praying that they become obsolete,
right.
You know, that I have no absolutely no reason to sing them anymore. And you know, the thing, Satellite Radio was basically, that's where that comes from, is dance hall. It comes from, you know, the idea of using, you know, my connection to hip-hop is as a form of folk music, and it was something I've always known about because the idea of reusing beats over and over again comes from Jamaica. It comes from sound systems, and that was the idea. And you know, once I started actually working with beats, I talked about it, and I've always liked a lot of music that was derived from that kind of stuff. To me, a couple of kids unpacking a piece of digital gear and starting to push buttons and see what happens is exactly the same thing as, you know, an NYU student with a banjo in 1958. It's basically making music to entertain yourself. And some people achieve a level of virtuosity and it ends up being, you know, what they do for the rest of their lives. And some people don't, but it's just as important, you know, is the idea that it's something that everybody can do. And that's where hip-hop comes from. It was the idea that, you know, okay, I'm playing these other records, but oh, I can push this a little bit further and actually be making music myself. And it's like any other kind of music. It's like it is folk music, but it's also, you wade through a lot of really underaccomplished stuff to get to the stuff that's really great. And that's true, you know, with any kind of art.
This next song that you're going to play for us, I think, so beautifully reflects New York City. And I sometimes think it takes an outsider to really write about a place like this.
Well, I mean, most of the writing about, you know, in all fairness, most of the writing about New York City has been done by outsiders. Joe Mitchell was from North Carolina. And you know, it's like, I mean, not that there aren't native New Yorkers. I was lucky enough. I learned this city from a handful of native New Yorkers that I know that never stopped looking up. You know, they say you can tell the tourists because they're, you know, walking around in Manhattan looking up at the buildings. And Joe Mitchell moved here when he was in his late 20s, and he never stopped looking up. You know, he died here. And Joseph Mitchell, for people that don't know, you know, I mean, I think most people that listen to this radio station probably do, but was my favorite nonfiction writer, wrote for The New Yorker in its heyday. And I'd seen his stories. I knew about, like, Joe Gould's Secret, which was a famous, you know, New Yorker article series of his. And I knew he was a great writer. And then Karen Schomer was interviewing me for the very first interview that I did after I got out of jail in the mid-90s. And she gave me a copy of The Bottom of the Harbor, which is this collection of Joe Mitchell stories. And that sort of got me, you know, on that path of, like, when I was here, looking at things a little bit differently. And, you know, just, you know, the Fulton Market and you know, where do these subway lines go? Why do some of them have numbers and some of them letters? And you know, the history of all that. And then, you know, you hang out around here. And after I moved here, it suddenly dawned on me how healthy it was for me right now, how lucky I was to get to live here at this point in our history, because there's some really incredibly offensive, ugly talk, you know, going on across the country. And, you know, Lou Dobbs. And it's another red herring. It's the idea that people are losing their jobs to people that are coming here from other countries trying to start a new life. Trust me, I travel all around the world, and what people love about us and what people want to support about us and the good they want to find in us is they still see this as a place where people can come from anywhere in the world and start with nothing, and, you know, this idea, and, you know, and make something of themselves, and more than that, and more importantly than that, make a life for their children and their children's children. You know, the idea, if you live in New York, you know that, you know, this idea of people speaking, the first generation of immigrants never learned to speak English. That's never historically happened. It's a miracle when it happens. It's the next generation that learns to speak English. All this idea, trust me, people think that there's something wrong with us because we think it might be a good idea to create a law that dictates that our children are restricted to learning one language in the course of their education. That just doesn't make any sense to anyone except Lou Dobbs.
Lou Dobbs gets it.
It's just a dangerous idea to me. And I don't, you know, living in New York is, you find out really quickly that people still, not only do they believe that about us, but they come here and they do it. And also, do you want to ride the wrong way in the rain down 6th Avenue and get your own Chinese food? You know, these people are taking jobs. They're jobs they're willing to do because they see something beyond them, and they do it. They accomplish it. They start new lives for themselves, for their families all the time, doing jobs that most Americans think are beneath them.
Well, that having been said, would you play that song for us?
Go traveling to open the door in the world while sin. Living in a city of immigrants. Living in a city that never sleeps. From hockey for time to a thousand beats. Singing languages I don't speak. Living in a city of immigrants. City of black. City of white. City of light. City of innocence. Up and touch the sky and then tumble back down to up again. Living in a city that never quits. Living in a city with paid with good intentions and a people's faith and a sacred promise, a statue made. Living in a city of immigrants. City of stone. City of steel. City of prayers. I'm living in a city.
Love that. Steve Earle and Allison Moore with us in Studio A today. You know, you touched on something, Steve, there for a second about the changing face of New York, and I think you speak about it very poetically in the song Down Here Below, where you talk about Hell's Kitchen is Clinton now, the Bowery's Nolita, the East Village is creeping across the Williamsburg Bridge. And, of course, there's a story in the paper today about how CBGB's is going to become a designer boutique.
That block there, I had a feeling that was coming in that block. But, you know, cities change. And you know, I am one of those people that I did manage to play CB's before it was over with. We talked about it years ago when The Mountain came out. We wanted to play CB's because that's originally, you know, Hilly opened the place as a bluegrass club and you know, for country and bluegrass. And that never materialized. It never happened there because, you know, the punk bands found it and it became their home. And he didn't care one way or the other. He was just trying to keep the joint up so him and his friends could drink there and park their motorcycles out front. So it was, you know, and it did that. But it got to the point where, you know, NYU owns all that property, and that's one of those things. The real estate business is what it is. And major universities, same thing happens in Nashville, Tennessee. Vanderbilt University is in the real estate business in a big way. So that's been going on for a long time. And it doesn't, sometimes mainly real estate agents and developers make up these names, new names for the neighborhoods. It's hilarious. And it's changed so much since I started coming to New York. Like, you know, Alphabet City has vanished off the face of the earth. That's the East Village now. And, you know, now you don't get to the Lower East Side till you get, you know, below Houston. And it's those name shift. Clinton never stuck. The only thing over there that's called Clinton, they tried that. But the only thing over there that's called Clinton I know of is a recording studio.
You know, the funny thing is the line that really brings it home for me is, there's no place left in this town for a poor boy to go.
It's true. I mean, it's. I'm lucky. I make an embarrassing amount of money for a borderline Marxist, so I can live in Manhattan. And you know, and somebody asked me, like, you know, whether I was moving, and I can be a snob about it. Somebody, you know, as little time as I've been here, somebody said, "Well, you're moving to Williamsburg, right?" And I'm like, "No, I did not wait till I was 50 years old and moved to New York to live in Brooklyn." That's one of those things. I wanted to live in Manhattan. That was always part of the deal, but. You know, it is tough, and it's going to get tougher, you know, as time goes on. But there's good sides and there's bad sides of it. I think it's the Buddhist concept of being mindful. There's some things that you can't, you know, on your own change at that moment. But as long as, you know, you're conscious of what's really going on, then you learn and you grow from it. So the idea that, you know, the truth of the matter is it's not just Donald Trump that makes New York change. It's also people that maybe are lefties, you know, people that think more like I do, but they feel safer than they did in 1986 downtown in New York. And so they're okay with the fact that it's become too expensive for poor people to live here, because these things that we find dangerous about living in big cities are problems that happen for the most part in neighborhoods where there are a lot of people that are struggling and having a hard time, and that's why we become dangerous to each other. The only flaw in that is I've seen people get hurt in Manhattan since I lived here by believing the real estate agents about what their neighborhood's like. There's still, you know, I have to run people out of my stoop, you know, every once in a while in the village, and it's because of certain realities that happen there. I saw somebody get hurt in Chinatown about 2 years ago, you know, literally shoved down into the, you know, it sounded like a story from 1981 or 82 downtown. And it's important to remember that the real estate agents don't, you know, what they want you to believe about whether your neighbor, how safe your neighborhood is and how much things have changed in reality aren't necessarily the same thing.
Now, that having been said, I understand you guys are working on a walking tour?
Yeah, it's a book that's designed to be a book about folk music in Greenwich Village.
Fun.
and that you can, that functions as a walking tour for you to go around and see those places, because we live in that neighborhood and we figured out where a lot of them are.
I want you guys to take me on that walking tour.
Oh, okay. It's good. Yeah,
with a microphone.
Come downtown.
Okay.
We end up doing it all the time. I spend a lot of my time out in the middle of the street turning Germans around who are facing the wrong direction trying to take their freewheeling cover picture. I want to make sure they get it right. So.
I would be remiss if I didn't ask you this. Allison, as you know, Steve has been married once or twice or six other times before. Not exactly a good bet. Or maybe I should ask Steve this. Steve, what's different now?
I've never been married sober before. I mean, you have to understand that people still define me by being a drug addict and having been married, you know, a bunch of times. But the truth of the matter is I've made a lot more records sober than I ever made loaded. I've been sober for over 13 years, and I never got married during all of that time.
Do you celebrate?
Until now.
Do you celebrate?
I got married a lot in the 80s. That was a long time ago, you know. So,
do you celebrate your sobriety date every year and do that whole nine?
Oh yeah, no. That is my spiritual system is 12-step programs, and that's what I do. I still go to meetings a couple times a week at least.
For me, it's just, you know, as Steve was saying earlier, you know, we certainly didn't expect this to happen, and at the end of the day, you can't help who you love.
Mm.
But I'm just not that scared of very much, and it just comes down to faith. It really does, you know. And life's too short to sit around and be scared of stuff. I've always been sure that I never made a decision to or not to do something because I was scared of it. I mean, you ought to be scared of getting married, period. You know, it's not, you know, it's like, oh, stay away from that person. Well, you know, you make your choices and then you make the best of it.
And keep in mind that I didn't get married all those times because I didn't believe in it. Because, I mean, I come from, my parents are still married and you know, I got married all those times because I thought that's the way it was supposed to be. And I, every single time I really was trying to make it work. And it's something that I believe in.
Well, I'm so happy for you both. Obviously.
It's working.
Certainly musically, and this is a wonderful record. And Steve, you worked with Allison on the record that she released earlier this year.
Yeah, but the new record, Allison's new record's coming in January, and that's why the tour doesn't start until then. We're playing a few festivals, but mainly the tour starts in January. Her record is Buddy Miller produced the new record simply because we couldn't both make records at the same time and me produce it. And it's called Mockingbird. It's covers of songs by female singer-songwriters, although there is one song of Allison's because Danny Goldberg, you know, said, well, you're a female singer-songwriter. You should have one song on there. So, but it's great. There's a Patti Smith song. There's a Joni Mitchell song. There's a breathtaking Kate McGarrigle song. There's like, I mean, it's really, really, really a cool record, and it'll be out in January. Yeah.
Well, since we don't have it yet, is it all right if we send you on your way with a track from this past record?
Absolutely, thank you.
All right. So great to see you both. Come and see us again soon, please.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Song written by Allison Moorer and Steve Earle. That's Fairweather from Allison's 2006 album, Getting Somewhere. The interview was engineered by Jim O'Hara, and Words and Music from Studio A is produced by Sarah Wardrop.
Words and Music is supported by McVicker and Higginbotham, offering direct mail and print solutions for alumni, membership, and marketing, serving New York schools, museums, and the performing arts since 1958. More information on the web and by emailing the president, Tim, at mcvh.com.
To hear more exclusive conversations and performances, visit the online archives at wfuv.org. I'm Rita Houston, and this is WFUV in New York.